Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Roguecast episode 278, recorded November 19th, 2019. Of Not Knowing.
We're back, gentlemen, with another recording of our podcast.
Hell yeah. Let's tear it up.
I don't have anything particular to say this
week. What are we tearing? I'm specifically, like...
It.
It?
Yeah, the movie It.
The evil clown.
Yeah. It came out today digitally, so...
Okay. Look at that serendipity. It's like I'm being written by Alan Moore.
Yeah. You know what else came out today? Eperon.
Oh, yeah.
I think people know.
Yeah, D&D Eperon,
well,
like...
This our is customers my... know, but I bet fully half of our listeners do not know what Eperon is.
It's my favorite setting for D&D. It was the official setting for D&D 3.5. And it was...
Wasn't the Forgotten Realms the official setting?
For D&D 3.
Oh, okay, for
3.5, Eberron was put out, and it was like somewhere where contests between game designers like come up with worlds and pitch them, and this one was pitched and created in-house, and I know Nick really enjoys this world, too.
Yeah, it's great.
It's got sort of a steampunky vibe, except it's not tech, it's magic.
Right, there are elementals that power trains and airships and things like that.
But I like all like the Casablanca-ness of the different houses or guilds that you can be involved in.
Right, it's got sort of politics. It's coming off this big world war.
And there's a weird space in the middle of the map that's where the last war took place.
Yeah,
and
wasn't that the source of their devastating? What would honestly be their Hiroshima, Nagasaki?
Yeah, there's definitely sort of a post World War II feel to it.
The
there's big mysteries like the Dragon Prophecy.
Yeah.
Yep. There's the City of Sharn.
It's a really cool world, and it's been out of print for like 10 years. Like 4th edition have one, and they haven't done one for 5th yet. And this week, the book came out with the original creator, Keith Baker, on board to help recreate it. A couple of the designers were originally
on it. But 4th edition wasn't even like a full-on Eperon book. It was just like an adventurer's guide to it.
No,
was
there
it?
Was two books.
Was there?
There was a player's book and a full-on Eperon book for 4th edition.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
For those who might be interested, there is, of course, the regular cover, which is cool, and a fancy, their designy cover, like their variant that they've been doing on all the D&D releases recently, that somewhat harkens back to old school D&D design sensibilities.
A little bit, yeah.
But has this, like, usually, like, beautiful metallic ink, and it's a really cool design.
It's fancy.
Yeah, it's fancy.
It's nice.
Is it the same price?
Yeah, same price.
Just another choice you get to make.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think a setting we would all say is well worth checking out. Honestly, even if you're not a D&D player and you just kind of want to read up on this really cool setting, I'd recommend it.
Yeah.
There are novels and things.
Yeah, that's true. I've read several of the novels. They're pretty good.
Yep.
Yeah, I have a huge fondness. I'm glad to see it come out. There was also Rick and Morty versus D&D.
Oh, right.
It's a new box set.
Yep.
That is, it's Rick and Morty D&D, which is very weird.
That is weird. Out of curiosity, do we know, like, how they stage it? Are you playing Rick and Morty? Are you just...
If I had to guess, because in the comic they were all different classes, all the main characters of the show. I figure you're playing one of them.
I believe the conceit is that Rick has created some kind of evil master dungeon that will kill everyone. You go in and you have to play, and I don't know if you take characters from that or what.
So, but you got to figure it's kind of like it's like still probably a first level D&D adventure, but I'm gonna guess with some messed up comedy in there.
Probably so.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, somebody buy it and let us look at it.
We got a couple of things coming up. Black Friday sales coming up on Friday, November 29th. That's our usual sale, so you can come in that day. Every $25 you spend, you get $5 in gift certificates.
Yep.
It's a good time and helps us, you know, make money for the holidays.
Yes, it keeps it's vital for stores like us to remain in your life.
Yep. And then... we got, you know, we'll be closed on Thanksgiving, as always.
Yep. That's the day we take a nap.
Yeah. Is it?
Sort of.
Yeah, eat a lot of food.
I'm planning to take a nap.
Yeah, good call.
We're not making food this year. We've decided we're just going to go to the Draft House and watch a movie and eat their food.
Really?
That sounds right. Well, you know, I for the last three or so years, I think, gone out for both Thanksgiving and sometimes Christmas dinner out to kind of really nice restaurants with my family. Places that are expensive, like we kind of do this in lieu of gifts, whereas like you might spend $50 or $100.
Don't you go to like the Four Seasons and things like that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one we kind of had to make the decision of cooking and then cleaning everything,
yep.
Or just having somebody do that for us and having no leftovers.
Yep. That, you know, and, for a lot of people, or like, actually, no matter who you are, I think Thanksgiving is kind of an exhausting day, you know?
I get that. I honestly, if I weren't doing family stuff, I would do like one of the many Friendsgivings that I have. I love a good potluck, and if you take me to a friend's like thing where I make one dish, and everybody cleans up their own stuff.
I will say, they're like great stuff to be had at potlucks.
If I'm not mistaken, I have my tickets for Knives Out, so I'm excited.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, nice. I feel like that's a good Thanksgiving Day thing, kind of darkly comic murder mystery.
Spend a day trying to figure out who killed somebody.
I really want that to be good.
The reviews are great.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Is that hitting next week?
I think it opens on Thanksgiving, doesn't it?
I think there's a special screening this weekend on like Saturday and Sunday, and then I think it opens on Thanksgiving.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'll be driving to Dallas.
Okay.
So with any luck.
But we're all going to probably try and catch it within the first week.
I'm hoping to maybe see it when I come back, if I'm not just exhausted from the driving and everything.
Oh, you're thinking the day of?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So we'll see.
Get your tickets now.
all right. So let's talk some news. A couple trailers. There is a trailer for DC's Harley Quinn Animated, which starts, I think, on the 29th, like the Friday after Thanksgiving.
I think so.
It's for a DC streaming service?
Yeah.
What do they call that?
The DC app. DC Universe app?
DC Universe, I think, yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's kind of weird. It's a weird thing because...
it's R-rated.
It's R-rated. Yeah, they dropped the F-bomb.
A lot.
They call the Legion of Doom the Legion of Dildos.
There's a lot of unnecessary blood.
Yeah, and yet the animation, which is okay... kind of looks like...
It actually looks like Rick and Morty. A little bit of that animation style.
Yeah.
I mean, it sort of looks like what I see when I see DC movies, but a little cartoonier. Like, I almost feel like it's an R-rated Batman Brave and the Bold or something.
Yeah.
And maybe that's how people should think of it. It's weird to me to see DC... I guess I'm used to it in sort of serious projects. I'm used to them embracing the R rating. They've been doing it with the Black Label for last year. And arguably, they've been doing some version of it ever since, say, Frank Miller did Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
So they dabble in that, but usually in serious projects. It's weird to see an anarchic comedic project. Nick, what was your thought on it?
I mean... I didn't need the necessary... all the F-bombs and things like that.
Did you think it looked funny?
I thought parts of it looked pretty funny.
Okay. And are you going to try it?
I'll try it. I'll try anything at this point.
You're going to have to report back to me, Nick.
I mean, the voice cast is solid. I mean, Alan Tudyk is the Joker. It sounded like Kevin Conroy's Batman still.
Interesting.
Anybody
in particular doing Harley?
I couldn't pin it down, actually. I couldn't pin down Harley or Poison Ivy.
Isn't that Tara Strong like usual?
No, it didn't sound like her.
You know what, this seems like the kind of anarchic Harley of not the Batman animated series, but of her own comic of the last, what, 6 or 7 years? But like with turned up for like a Deadpool movie R rating, kind of.
But it looked like this did have a story drive. I mean, it had a story that it was doing. It was her trying to join the Legion of Doom.
I mean, that's a story, but it's kind of like a gimmick story you do for comedic stuff. I don't know if there's like... I mean, it's hard to imagine they're going to do character development.
Probably.
It doesn't seem like their thing.
You never know.
But you never know. Randy, you sound... I think you're as excited as I am.
I think I'm less excited. I believe everyone knows my opinion on DC.
On a scale, he's at like a negative 20.
So Nick, you will be our lone man out there in the field.
Yeah, our canary in the coal mine.
Our
one dead motherfucking canary.
I can guarantee you our staffer Anna is watching it.
Yeah,
that's probably true.
She excited for it?
I don't know, but I would assume so.
All right, we'll confer with her after the podcast. what else we got, Randy?
All right, there's a trailer for Avenue 5, which is the new project from Armando Iannucci, who did Veep.
Yep.
Hugh Laurie is playing the sort of captain of this luxury space vessel.
Looks like a darkly comic space love boat.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly
what
I'm saying.
You had me at Hugh Laurie. I'll watch pretty much anything.
It looks like fun. The trailer is only okay funny. It's not like hilarious, but I like what I've seen. And Josh Gad plays like this obnoxious space millionaire who is like the guy who funds the whole thing.
Named the boat Judd, which I think is his character.
Which is his name. it looks like fun.
If you've by chance seen the movie Passengers with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt, it has that same sort of luxury liner sci-fi look, but with a more comedic bend.
Yeah.
I'm also going to let y'all let me know how that looks. It didn't grab me from the trailer, but I do see it as being one of those kind of trailers where it might have looked merely solid and may actually turn out pretty, really quite good.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it does have a really excellent cast. So. What else?
The Rock posted on November 14th about Black Adam. He posted this sort of heartfelt thing about how he's like, he's too rebellious to be Superman. He's
or like when kid. He was growing up, he couldn't pretend to be Superman.
But he was a good kid with a good heart, and he's like, I'm going to play Black Adam. He's rebellious, one of a kind superhero who will always do what's right for his people, but does it his way. Truth and justice, the Black Adam way. And I'm like, is this just your take? Because that does not sound like Black Adam at all.
He's like a pretty big misread of the character.
Yeah. Well, he ain't right in the movie.
I mean, I guess from one perspective, Teth Adam is a hero.
Right, but maybe to like his people, to the people of Kandak.
Yes.
The closest we have seen in the comic is, for sure, they have at times, well, he's had his own series before, and Geoff Johns, I think, more than anyone else, was responsible for making him a sort of tough nationalist for Kandak, his fictional Middle Eastern nation.
Johns also had him on the JSA for a while.
Yeah. He wanted to have him, I think, a little bit as their Wolverine, the guy who would do what it takes.
Yeah.
And it is weird to me to imagine that, like, kids who are fans of The Rock might be like, yeah, I'm going to dress as Black Adam. He's my new favorite hero. He crushes people's heads.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
But then again, I do have some faith in the writers. I think they did a good job in the first Shazam movie. And
I don't know if it's the same writers.
Oh, well, that would be a problem then.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to do something where, like, you know, he and Shazam are enemies at first, but then must team up against a greater evil. I hope it's not that kind of, because that almost speaks of, like, a both sides kind of.
Yeah.
Well, there's some weaknesses in Shazam's philosophy, and there's some weaknesses in my genocidal philosophy. But together we can team up and beat Savannah.
Happy genocide.
That said, I do like Black Adam as a villain with a noble streak, I guess, is what I would prefer.
And I think
him
The
as.
Rock could portray that very well.
Don't you think, Randy? Like, he's like, I think more like Dr. Doom in some ways is how I like to view him. You know, villain with noble streak.
Yeah, you know that hero, Dr. Doom.
Yes. he gets it done his way.
Yes, Dr. Doom does it his way.
The Burger King of supervillainy.
But they gave us a date, December 22nd, 2021.
Yeah.
So I guess that's happening.
Okay, sure.
So, yeah. I'm as excited about it as I am all the other DC movies coming my way.
I'm going to hope that the pedigree of the first Shazam movie carries through enough to get them another winner. But
we still have to get through the anarchic Birds of Prey movie.
Yep.
I saw the new trailer that they dropped on in front of Charlie's Angels, and I still think it looks like a lot of fun.
I saw a trailer just the other day, and I thought it was the same trailer I'd seen before.
Or maybe it was, but I guess seeing it on the big screen was
a little
bit
different.
The
first time that I had seen it on the big screen the other day.
And I was like, oh, this looks like fun.
Well, I am definitely looking forward to Guardians of the Galaxy. Suicide Squad.
I liked the first time I saw it. I'm a little hesitant. I feel like I'm in the cautiously pessimistic realm. Ready to potentially enjoy it. But not what you call looking forward to it,
Dave,
exactly.
Join me in the pits of hatred.
Let me get through it. If it's of the quality of, say, the first Suicide Squad, I'll join you in the pits of hatred.
You like the first Suicide Squad?
But I know it's not like really a good movie. I can sometimes like movies in spite of what they put out there. That is to say, it had enough qualities to entertain me. But I don't think it's really like really a good movie.
All right. Speaking of movies, this is a weird one. Nicolas Cage is in talks to star as Nicolas Cage in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Yes.
This one, I really hope this happens.
Is it The Unbearable Weightness of His Massive Talent? Of His Massive Talent?
Yes.
Okay.
So, this is interesting. I hadn't noticed that Nicolas Cage has not been on a major movie since 2011, when he was in Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance.
And yet, he's been in like 30 movies that have gone straight to video.
He's been a lot of weird crap.
I feel like, the indie movie Mandy, I think, is probably the thing that most stood out. All my film nerd friends saw it.
So, if the deal closes, I gotta read this whole thing. He's so desperate to get a role in a new Quentin Tarantino movie while also dealing with a strange relationship with his teenage daughter. He also occasionally talks to an egotistical 1990s version of himself who rides him for making too many crappy movies and for not being a star anymore. He's under a mountain of debt, finds himself forced to make an appearance at the birthday party of a Mexican billionaire who happens to be a fan of his work and shows him the script on which he's been working. While he bonds with the man, Cage is informed by the CIA that Billionaire is actually a drug cartel kingpin who has kidnapped the daughter of a Mexican presidential nominee, and Cage is recruited by the government to get intelligence.
So this is like an ultimate meta movie. It's like a movie about him making bad movie choices while he's actually sort of in a movie that will end up emulating them.
Yep.
I never saw JCV, the Jean-Claude Van Damme meta movie, but I think it was a little like this. If not quite as outrageous, maybe.
No.
But, like, he played, like, a fictionalized sort of version of himself, a actor past his prime, or, like, an action hero past his prime, right?
I think so.
Anyway, we have to go see this if it comes out. That's all I know, for sure.
Yeah.
Completely.
DC has announced that The Deceased, which just ended, they're going to do a spinoff called Deceased Unkillables in February. I believe it's a 3-issue miniseries. Basically shows what happens when these sort of street-level villains and anti-heroes fight against the zombies. So Red Hood, Deathstroke, and some of the other sort of villains of the DC Universe dealing with the events of Deceased.
Is this Tom Taylor?
It is Tom Taylor again.
Okay, so the original writer, y'all like Deceased, which has a collection, I believe, coming out this week?
Yep.
Is this a good idea or not? Should they let it lie, or is this something that to run into the ground the way Marvel did Marvel Zombies?
I'm all for a Loner story by Tom Taylor.
Okay.
The second they hand it off to somebody else, I'm out.
Yeah.
But Tom Taylor wants to write more in that world? Sure, that's fine. Finally, there's one little bit of news that dropped right at the end here I thought was interesting. Netflix has closed deals with Robert Towne, the original scriptwriter for Chinatown, or is he the original director?
I think he was the original director. Okay.
And David Fincher to work up a pilot script for a prequel to Chinatown.
A prequel TV show?
No, it'd be a prequel series, yeah. Focusing on the young Jake.
Hmm.
I actually never quite bonded with Chinatown the way some people did, but I kind of would like to revisit it. You know, it's everyone's favorite creepy director, Roman Polanski, right?
Yep.
And Jack Nicholson, among others, a bunch of other great character actors, great actors. And you know, kind of one of those really kind of gloomy noir movies. Even people who haven't seen it sometimes know the line, it's Chinatown.
It's Chinatown, yep.
I kind of trust in Fincher. I sort of wouldn't mind him doing a period piece noir series. It's a little strange to, like, try and... You know, of course, Chinatown had a sequel, The Two Jakes.
Which was, all by all accounts, not great.
Yeah. I don't know if it had the same aspirations as the other one did. You know, one of the things I'm kind of interested about Chinatown is, I know, like, to rewatch it, the original, is it has, like, a, I think the big plot, Nick, have you seen it in a while? It has to do with, like, water rights and stuff like that. Like, it sounds like it could be kind of boring, but I have this feeling that, like, you know, as we see more and more this attempts of corporate control over water rights, like Nestle and all that stuff, that may be more timely than it used to be. There's also some dark family secrets kind of in the Gothic tradition of sort of dark reveals about that. I want to revisit Chinatown, and I think I'd be up to check out this series. It sounds interesting to me.
Yeah.
Last series Fincher did was Mindhunter, which is probably my favorite series right at the moment.
Yeah, we all like it.
Yep.
All right, let's be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics week of Wednesday, November 20th, and there's a bunch of new number ones and stuff this week, but I think all of us fell back on sort of familiar friends here.
Well, I think you and I may, I can't remember what you're picking, Randy, but I believe there was a couple collections that just rose to the top for us of some best of series from recently.
Yeah, so. We're I don't know about you guys, but I'm working on my best of the year as always.
Yes, I've definitely thought about it a lot since last we mentioned it here on the podcast.
I think you're lying.
But look, my number one standalone issue, we already know, is the Black Cat where she goes on a date with Batroc.
That was 2 weeks ago.
But I've added that to my list.
My best graphic novel
is going to be what I pick as my pick today.
That's two things.
Yeah.
It's better than mine, which my list is a problem for future Nick. It's fine.
Yes.
Your list is just House of X.
No, there were some other projects that might have...
It's true. There were.
...risen to the top for Nick.
All right, well... Let's start with your pick, Dave.
All right. So my pick for this week and my best of 2019 graphic novel. No, just kidding. We'll have to see. But it'll be in the running, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Is the collected edition of Blade Runner 2019 from Titan Comics.
Yeah.
Definitely the best series I've read from Titan, which has put out good Doctor Who comics and other things, but not a lot to quite stand out.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about this in the past, so I'm not going to give like the sort of long push for it. This story has a new Blade Runner who we haven't met. It runs concurrently with the movie.
I think so.
The movie doesn't really cross over into it.
It's just set in that world,
right? Which I think is good. Like I didn't need her to talk to Deckard or to run afoul of Leon or something like that, but it's roughly that same time. It is not Blade Runner, what, 2049?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that in that far-flung future. She's investigating the disappearance of a woman and her child, and she's hired by a sort of a business tycoon who's a close friend of Terrell. And obviously there are lots of sort of twists and turns dealing with replicants and things like that. She also has her own sort of secrets in a, you know, sort of classic noir tradition. And it was just one good issue after the next, strong character scenes, good control of the mystery, there's like small reveals here and there, but, you know, a little ways into the story, they reveal a lot. It ended strongly, which we touched on just the other day. It had good art. It also took you to some places you don't normally see in the Blade Runner universe, as well as kind of the familiar rainy streets of L.A.
Yeah.
Now, as I'm looking at this graphic novel, there's at least some bonus stuff in it, too. So I think you get all the variant covers in the back. When I was flipping through it, yeah, I think that's all of them. There's some sketchwork stuff, and they show how the covers were designed and developed. There's character design work. So it's actually kind of a... Nice little promo. Oh, and there's an ad in there for, I believe, the upcoming miniseries referred to as Offworld. So that'll presumably take place in the Offworld colonies, which I don't think we've ever seen. Did they show that in Blade Runner 2049?
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
No. It's interesting. I think all of us were skeptical about this. We're like, I don't know about more stories set in the Blade Runner universe, but it's really good.
Right. Well, it's something like I can say I wanted. It has about, I'm going to say, the same kind of track record as like sort of Watchmen did, which is to say a sort of singular vision where it used to be there was a Blade Runner sequel novel years ago, which was by all accounts terrible. I'm talking like 15, 20 years ago at least, I think. That was apparently terrible. And they adapted it for comics to Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, but used a little bit of, like, I think the visual style for the covers to try and trick people into thinking.
Well, they had some weird license where they had to have the entire text of the novel in there.
Right. It was just a drawn version of the novel, but without much interpretation.
Yeah.
Anyway, like, but they finally hit on it. It was something I wanted to see and didn't know. And in the same sort of happy way that, say, the Watchmen show from HBO is proving to be very interesting, this turned out to be they finally kind of, I think, got the formula right for a Blade Runner comic.
I agree. Nick, what you got?
I want to talk about some pirates. And those are the pirates of the X-Men book Marauders.
Uh-huh.
Second issue hits this week, and we sort of see a bit more with what Kitty is doing as she sort of transport goods and stuff to Krakoa, and also rescuing mutants who are unable to go through portals to Krakoa.
Are there out of harm's way? I thought she was the only mutant who couldn't go through a portal.
I think she is. I mean, so far.
There's like repressive governments that are keeping their mutants from leaving.
Like the Russians are keeping people away. They're like guarding with military forces.
It's interesting.
And here she and her group of ragtag, her team of ragtag mutants, runs against everyone's favorite Frenchman.
Yeah, Batroc is back. This is Batroc's year.
Is
there a third Batroc appearance? That'll make it a trend.
You just got to hold out.
It's true. The year's not over.
Yeah.
He'll show up again.
You got about a month and a half left, Marvel, for Batroc Part 3.
But there's also sort of a lot of back and forth between Emma Frost and Sebastian Shaw,
Like, there seemed to be, like, political machinations going on.
Well, because Xavier needed a company to sort of farm out the distribution of the drugs that his plants created.
Boy, the X-Men is a different world than it used to be. Xavier's working on drug distribution.
Yep. Sure.
Those are the big questions of our time. Yep.
The Hellfire Club essentially stood up, and that is the distribution.
I need the Hellfire Club to move my drugs for me.
Emma Frost is moving it to, like, the reputable, like, people who have basically sanctioned, or not sanctioned, but agreed with Xavier to support him. And Sebastian Shaw is
to my allies.
And Sebastian Shaw is the people dealing with the black market stuff.
Did everybody get amnesty, including Sebastian Shaw?
Yeah, he's actually Sebastian Shaw and Emma Frost are on what they call the Quiet Council.
So they are essentially allies, which is to say, all mutants are allies on Krakoa.
Yes.
And the stuff they're supplying, it's like the same drugs that we saw in the House of X
Powers of X. Yeah, it's basically miniseries. The drugs that, like, eradicate, like, diseases of the mind, keep the... basically adds 5 years to a person's life, and I forget what the third drug is.
This is, like, an obvious question, but are they real sure of Krakoa the Island's motives? Like, in 5 years or 3 years or whatever, is Krakoa going to be like, oh yeah, everybody who's taken my drug is now under my control?
I don't know. In the second X-Men, Krakoa had sex with another island and created a new, bigger island, so who knows?
The X-Men comics have really gotten real strange.
Did they have mind sex, or did, like, tendrils reach out along the ocean floor, or did the islands glide along and bump into each other, sort of?
More the second thing, but some of the third thing.
Okay. Well... It's a strange new world. Brave new world.
Whoever had $5 on when will they discuss island sex on the roadcast, collect your money.
So Nick, what was like your favorite part about the issue? What was the coolest thing in it?
I just like some of the inclusion of kind of the weirder characters in the X-Men universe. There's Gateway shows up, which I'm like, I haven't seen Gateway in a while. Bishop comes into the picture, which I... As a kid growing up in the 90s, there wasn't anyone cooler than Bishop.
Bishop's a cool-looking dude.
Also, the X-Men get tattoos.
And the X-Men get tattoos.
Yeah, really? Which Bishop, that's kind of fun.
Which Bishop abstains because he already has one.
Yeah, that's kind of messed up. Yeah. Kitty had tattoos in the early 2000s.
Yeah, she got tattoos again.
I also really like the combo of Pyro and Lockheed. I don't know why it is so fun, but...
Does Lockheed make fire and Pyro control the fire? Controls it,
yeah. And they work in conjunction with each other.
It's kind of a fun idea.
Yeah. And that's sort of the kind of, in a nutshell, why I like this. It's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's dealing with big ideas. I mean, the idea
drug
of...
Drug pushing.
Drug moving and saving people... from death.
Yeah. Yeah, right. They're in fact, like, yeah, they are there's serious stuff going on. They're essentially delivering medical supplies, and they are also trying to, like, free refugees.
Yeah.
But along the way, good times.
Yeah. Well, there's tattoos and booze.
And
yeah.
Also, I have a huge fondness for the Hellfire Club, so seeing them kind of put into such prominence,
I sort of appreciated that, at least on that cover, I know there's multiple covers, that they kind of are, that Emma was given a kind of fancy feathery white dress and not just another sort of boob-tacular one.
Yeah.
She's
in fancy dress.
She's in fancy dress. And Sebastian Shaw's in there. It looks cool.
But I like that they're at odds, and Emma is definitely kind of holds a lot of the cards over him. There's just, like, a nice power dynamic between the two characters. I'm enjoying it.
So my pick is another one of these projects that was definitely one of, it's going to be on my best of list for the year somewhere. It's Tom Taylor, who's a writer I really appreciate, doing a concept just like Injustice where I'm like, I don't think I want to see that concept. And yet...
And Tom Taylor's like, I'll tell you what you want to see.
Yeah, it was executed so well. That concept is Deceased, which is basically an anti-life equation creating zombies on the and destroying Apocalypse in the first issue.
Yep.
And then... It is about Earth superheroes trying to turn back a zombie invasion.
This hardcover collection came out close on the heels of the ending of the single issues.
It's maybe even a month.
Yeah. But that's not normal, right?
No, I think they're speeding up the production of it.
Yeah, so or maybe they just wanted this to get out as a nice Christmas edition, because it is a very beautiful-looking book.
Give the gift of doomed stories for Christmas.
Let me ask this. Yep. Is there any comedy in it? Like,
For sure.
Dark humor?
Taylor's got a lot of that character stuff that's really good.
It's kind
of
what he did with Injustice.
Does this have the one-shot in there, too?
Yes. Okay. It's got the six issues and the one-shot. It's got every variant cover, which that was one of the big things. They do these horror movie homage covers. So those are all in there. And then it's got a little bit at the end where it's like a four-page or maybe six-page deceased pitch and series outline by Tom Taylor.
Oh, interesting. So you can see how he got his job in case you're looking to become a DC writer, and aren't we all?
Yep. also on my list this week, Immortal Hulk number 27, and then there's Spider-Verse number 2, and... there's a bunch of new number ones from Marvel this week. So there's like Annihilation Scourge, which starts the return of the sort of the space characters. 2099 Alpha, which starts the return of Marvel 2099. There's also Fantastic Four 2099 as a one-shot. There's a bunch of image book, or a couple of image books, Heart Attack and Olympia. And then a boom book, Heartbeat, by Maria Lovett, who's the artist on that Faithless that a lot of y'all loved.
Yep.
And then real quick mention... there is a couple hardcovers. There's Nathan W. Pyle's Strange Planet, which is the weird little alien strips you've seen online, where they talk funny and they're like, it's the star damage. I crave star damage. Those little aliens.
Oh yeah, the super literalist.
Yeah.
Basically, they make sort of normal sequences, normal bits of daily life seem bizarre by lensing them through super literalist aliens.
Yeah. It's a little hardcover collection of that. Then there's a Usagi Yojimbo 35 Years of Covers, which is this gorgeous hardcover, oversized, of all the covers Usagi, Stan Sakai has done for Usagi.
And they've got some beautifully painted covers.
And it's really nice, full color, in their sort of Dark Horse's big deluxe format. Also, the Kill or Be Killed hardcover that has the complete Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips crime story that we all really like.
Delightful series. It's like crime with a supernatural tinge and sort of a psychological element.
Dave, what else is on your stack?
Let's see. Randy, did you mention Annihilation Scourge?
I did.
Okay, just want to make sure, since I know that we've got some fans of Annihilation in the series, they've done two over the years with a few ancillary series that, people knew that this was like the lead into it. Speaking of minis on the Absolute Carnage front, there's a Captain Marvel. I don't know if it's a one-shot or miniseries, but if you wanted to see her cat, aka her Flerken, get possessed by Carnage and have to fight her, this is the issue for you. Let's see, DC's got a new Black Label miniseries by Jeff Lemire of The Question, and this seems to be combining elements of The Question from Steve Ditko's run, from Danny O'Neill's run. I noticed a little bit of Rorschach homage in there, as well as a little bit of the conspiracy theorizing of the Justice League Unlimited version. And he's working with the artist from the 80s series, Dennis Cowan, and was Bill Sienkiewicz the anchor on that
one? He might have been.
Or did he covers or
he
something
covers.
With them? Let's see. There's the second part of the manga adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness is out. This is the one that has that just really meticulous, wildly beautiful and disturbing art in it. It's some of the most detailed manga art I've ever seen, and it's a very faithful adaptation of it. Let's see. IDW puts out I think the first Big Hero 6 comic they've done.
Yeah.
I know they've done a few little small kids books, but this is, I think, based on the cartoon that's running probably on Disney Channel right now. But anyway, if you like Big Hero 6 and you've been like, why have they never done a comic based on that? Well, they have now. let's see. The second issue of the sci-fi porn kind of comic Money Shot, in which in a anti-science future, scientists, in order to fund their interstellar experiments and travels, are forced to go off and make porn movies with aliens. I didn't create the idea. I'm just reading it, but it's pretty entertaining. It's a very comedic comic, but also, like, I guess, sort of with sexy times in it.
Yep.
So the second issue of that is hit, and one of the more bonkers ideas that I've come across lately. This is He-Man and the Masters of the Multiverse, And I guess what I can say is it does kind of for He-Man, this is Tim Seeley writing, by the way, what the Spider-Verse did for Spider-Man, which is to say, and also it's a little bit of Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is there's forces that are traveling between the different He-Man multiverses and like destroying them, killing people. And so various different incarnations of He-Man and his allies must gather. I think they're even trying to find Skeletor in this one to ally with him. But among other things, I saw the Dolph Lundgren He-Man in here.
Gwildor is in there.
Gwildor. Some strange chibi version, almost their Spider-Ham, I'm going to say.
Yep.
From something I don't even know, but was some kind of special that they did. Some kind of
comic special. I believe an Easter special.
Yes. So it is a strange deep dive, but I know Tim Seeley's got a lot of love for the property. And I'm sure probably the He-Man cartoon from the, mid-2000s is making its way in here. Anyway, strange but interesting. Nick, anything else to mention?
Yeah, Gwenpool number 4, which sees her battling Hulk, utilizing various iterations of herself from various comics. It continues to be kind of insane and fun.
And if you read that book, Anna will high-five you.
That's true, she will.
If you don't like it, she'll high-five you in the face.
Speaking of insane and slightly incomprehensible, yet still fun, Hazel and Cha-Cha... The time-traveling assassins from Umbrella Academy get a one-shot called Hazel and Cha-Cha Save Christmas.
Do they save Christmas?
They inadvertently save Christmas, because they're kind of insane.
Is it? Am I correct that it is Gerard Way on writing, but some different artists on art?
It is Gerard Way and Scott Alley doing the story. Art is actually entirely by Tommy Lee Edwards. And Tommy Lee Edwards is a great artist and does an amazing job here.
Nice.
It's
a series that's always had a history of really great artwork. So hoping that even without, was it Gabriel Ba?
Fabian Moon.
That it had good looks.
If you like Umbrella Academy, you like those characters, definitely want to check out. The final issue of Absolute Carnage hits. There are some big things that happen there.
I hope there's some carnage.
There is carnage.
I'm pretty sure carnage has occurred throughout every issue.
Yeah. It's very true.
Yeah.
Batman number 83, which is a sad issue of Batman, but very good.
How long till the finale? What's
Two
the last
more
issue?
Issues.
85 is the 85 final?
85 is the finale.
Okay.
Deadpool number 1 sees Deadpool going after giant monsters and joining forces with Monster Hunter Elsa Bloodstone.
Oh, nice. I was like, Elsa Bloodstone?
Yeah.
Sorry, she had to appear in a Deadpool comic, but it is what it is.
And then finally, the second issue of Excalibur, which is Captain Britain, the new Captain Britain, Betsy Braddock, joining forces with Apocalypse and a small band of mutants fighting Morgan Le Fay on the home isle of like where the lighthouse in the actual original Excalibur book was.
Plus, there's monstrous Selkies in it.
There are.
The weird Irish. Which I think
Marcus Toe did a really good job with their look.
They look really cool, yeah. That's one of those things that's a little bit risky to kind of portray the seal-like mermaids of folklore and make them look monstrous, and I thought they did a very good
job. Yeah, we got some good battles. There's actually some good character development with Jubilee and her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And some more about Apocalypse, too, which I thought was interesting. Or whatever the hell his new name is. I don't know. Giant A.
Terry.
Terry. Yes, we'll just call him Terry.
All right. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some movies and some TV. All right. Well, as you know, Dave and I both have the Alamo Movie Pass.
Yes.
And we see lots of movies. And Nick just sees lots of movies.
It's true.
I don't even think you put in for the other movie pass.
No.
But it's in,
watching
your blood.
Movies.
It's in your blood because you managed a video store.
Yeah, for 10 years. It's kind of in there.
So Dave, you went and saw a movie that I'm very interested in seeing. I'm not sure if I'm getting around to it, but Parasite by Bong Joon-ho?
Bong Joon-ho.
I was close.
Yes, I was looking it up even before I said this, and I probably even pronounced it wrong, although it looks straightforward to me. He's a director who's probably best known, he's a Korean director who made The Host, which was kind of a bit of a breakout horror monster movie in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Snowpiercer was probably his big crossover hit because it was an English language movie. This Parasite is his new one, and like Snowpiercer, it is clear he is interested in class struggle. That is like maybe... made his first and foremost thing as a director.
He also did Okja, which was a Netflix thing, and that was a sort of a look at animal cruelty and also a little bit of class as well.
Oh, that was him.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I still
haven't seen
that.
I've only seen Snowpiercer of those, and I kind of want to at least watch Okja.
Okja is hard to watch.
Really?
I mean, if you
it's
love
a fictionalization,
animals,
right? About like some fictional
it's
creature
like
or something.
Yeah, it's like creating a new sort of cow. Yeah. It's like one that's supposed to be more environmentally friendly and blah 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 blah. Of course, there's a lot of.
There's a nasty corporate stuff going on.
Yes,
and I'm gonna guess some hideous cruelty.
Yes, if you love animals, it is hard to watch.
But that's interesting. I forgot he made that. He seems like a very morally driven filmmaker.
Yeah.
But I will say this: he is a very compelling storyteller.
I need to watch The Host. I've never watched The Host.
You know, I will say, of the movies I've seen of his, The Host, and maybe I'd like it more on a second viewing, but I found it very uneven.
Okay.
In the same way, every once in a while, I will see a foreign film, and I'm like, oh, this pacing is just weird to me. It's real slow at times, and, you know, like, I didn't love The Host, but I have a feeling I might plug into it more going back to it.
Yeah.
So, Parasite, without saying too much about it, you can probably glean, at least from the trailer, that it's based around an attempt to sort of con a wealthy family. There's a guy who's been tutoring a girl in a wealthy family. She's like high school age. And he's got to go away, study abroad or something like that. And he's worried about like some sort of lecherous frat boy type tutor coming in. Who's going to be all over her because he actually wants to date her whenever she goes to university. He's fallen for her.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to his friend, which is one of the lead characters, and he's like, you should say that... And by the way, this is a guy who's... His whole family is essentially broke. There's kind of darkly comic scenes early on of how broke the family is. They're all living together. It's like a mother, father... son and daughter, I think.
Okay.
And then the son and daughter are all like around college age, or both around college age. Anyway, this guy goes to his friend, who's the son, and he says, he's like, you tutor her. I think I'll feel safe with you doing it. And the guy's like, but I haven't gone to university. I'm not like a qualified tutor. And he's like, you can fake it. He's like, everybody in this family is oblivious, and you could pull it off. And, I really want to give as minimal as I can about what goes on in the movie because y'all should see it.
Yep.
And B, the kind of the it's actually not even like the twists and turns I expected from the trailers, so that's kind of neat. But suffice to say, there is what it reminded me most of. Have you ever seen this is a weird thing in comparison, but have you ever seen the movie Dangerous Liaisons?
Yeah.
Or even its schlocky remake with Sarah Michelle Gellar. What was that called?
Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions.
Yeah.
All right, you know how, like, sort of the first half of Dangerous Liaisons feels like a little bit of kind of dark fun and games?
Yeah.
It's very watchable watching them manipulate people and stuff like
yep.
that. And then things take a darker turn as it goes along.
Yeah.
Well, structure-wise, this has something in common with that.
Okay.
And I will say this, it's really fun and kind of fascinating throughout the whole movie, even though it does take those dark twists and turns. And watching these sort of... the con job and exactly the unusual way it unfolds is super interesting. I need to read a little bit more on it because there's a few things, like if you take it as an allegory and you start dissecting elements, there's a few things I'm maybe a little confused by, but I it was actually one of the most watchable movies I've seen the whole year. It did not have, I would say, any of the normal barriers other than reading subtitles of a foreign movie. Like it felt very... not American, but it had, like, somewhat, I would say, sort of Western film sensibilities, so that it's intriguing, it's suspenseful, it's funny very often, and the characters are actually something I want to talk about with y'all once you've seen it.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't want to say why. But let me just go ahead and give a blanket recommendation of Parasite. Catch it while it's in theaters. I'm not going to say any more about the plot because it's fun to discover on your own. And it will definitely leave you thinking, but it's not a movie that you go to, like, it's not, like, take your medicine. It's a fun movie, too.
Okay, all right.
It works as a suspenseful, fun movie.
I know a lot of my movie friends have been putting this on, like, their best of the year list and really enjoying it. Do you like it to that extent?
Of all the movies that I've looked at on Rotten Tomatoes, it has the highest rating of this year. It's, like, 98% or something like
yeah.
that. I would say it would definitely rank probably in my top 10 of the year, maybe in my top 5. There's a good chance it would be in my top 5.
Nick, you went and saw Charlie's Angels, which I also want to see at some point.
Yeah, well, I have a huge fondness for just, I guess, Charlie's Angels in general. I love the original, or the show was fun. I watched reruns.
But we're talking about the crazy McGee movie.
Then the McGee movie happened, and that was pretty great.
1990s, 96 or something like that?
It was 2000, Charlie's Angels 2000.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, and that was Drew Barrymore and Cameron Diaz and Lucy Liu.
Bill Murray.
Bill Murray. Yep.
We all like that.
Right.
Movie.
It is a kind of a wild, somewhat throw everything in the kitchen sink in it, with some dopey comedy, some sly comedy, some sexiness, some music video sensibilities from McGee.
Well, it comes with like the edict from Drew Barrymore that they didn't use guns.
Yep. And it was post Matrix, so they grabbed Yen Wu Ping for the fight choreography on Matrix.
Right.
And it's a weird time capsule in some ways of what was going on in action cinema at that point.
It also, by the way, had a unusually cast villain in it of Crispin Glover as the main henchman.
Creepy thin man.
What I loved about, by the way, that was that Crispin Glover is the least threatening person in the world. Yeah. Except maybe when he's on acid and scaring David Letterman.
Or when he's controlling piles of rats.
Right.
In Willard
but
style.
Otherwise, not a threatening man. But they made him this really cool, super martial arts, sword fighting, like maniac who sniffed people's hair.
Yes.
In the movie. And it was fun. So I think we all at least kind of hoped that this new one would operate at least somewhat in that territory, even though the movie, I could tell from the trailer, it was a different beast.
Yeah,
so tell me what it's like.
I don't want to spoil too much because you guys should go see it. But it definitely works in continuity with the other movies.
Really?
Yes.
Those were some crazy movies. How could it be in continuity? It looked like they used guns and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a different, like, something that happens and becomes something else, but it works in came before it happened.
That actually kind of intrigues me. Do you mean, like, the movie, like, literally goes out of its way to some way indicate that those movies are in continuity?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, I did not expect that. I wouldn't have minded if they just completely rebuilt it from the ground up, but that kind of intrigues me that they're going to try and incorporate those.
Yeah, this one has a good villain in it.
Okay.
Got some good twists and turns. The three leads, Naomi Scott, Kristen Stewart, and I don't know the other girl in it because she's new to me. She looks a little Sarah Michelle Gellar-ish at times. But it was, they're really good together.
One of the key fun things I think about the McGee movie was that it kind of felt like in the same way that Cannonball Run seemed like Burt Reynolds and his pals hanging around and like kind of having the best time. Like it was kind of infectious. Even if sometimes the dialogue was dopey a little bit, it kind of had that fun feel of like kind of friends getting together.
Yeah.
So Lucy Liu and Drew and Cameron D and Destiny... Sorry, I started doing the song. They looked like they were having fun, and so does any of that carry over with these? Do they have a good repartee?
Yeah, they do. They've got good banter between each other. Kristen Stewart, which I feel like is the loose wild card kind of, I wasn't sure what she was going to bring to the table, because I've never been blown away by her acting ability.
Uh-huh.
She actually is one of the biggest... brightest stars of the movie with her kind of awkward humor and kind of just her general demeanor is interesting.
Interesting. I think I skimmed a review at some point, and I think they said the same thing, that Kristen Stewart was something of a standout.
Yeah. But overall, it's got some great action sequences.
How is the camp level? It did not look as high as McGee's level.
No, I don't think it... It's a different thing.
No biscuits or muffins thrown into a
correct.
Into walls.
There are no Chinese fighting muffins.
Muffins, yeah.
What is her name? Elizabeth Banks is the director in this. She also stars as a character in this. I will not reveal who she is.
Okay.
But her take is a little different.
Okay.
But like I said, it works. It really does.
I believe when I looked, I think, Randy, I told you at some point that if it got over 50% on Rotten Tomatoes, I'd probably go see it. And I think I saw it holding around 60, maybe a little over 60%.
The original one is like 65 or something. It's not high.
Yeah, I don't need a movie that's a masterpiece. You go to kind of Charlie's Angels for kind of a little bit of campy good fun.
Yeah.
Maybe some cool action, some good character repartee.
I will say stay through the credits.
Okay.
There are a lot of little snippets here and there that are a lot of fun.
Speaking of credits, Nick, did you ever see the second Zombieland?
No, I didn't.
Okay, just checking.
I need
Scold.
To. I know. There's so many movies I need to see.
Yeah.
But
that's good to hear. I'll try and catch it.
I did not see any movies this week, but I did play some games. I played Lantern's Dice, which is the it's like the Lantern's Harvest Festival. It's a tile building game. This is the dice version where you have like four players. You roll dice, you choose which ones, and you like mark off your sheet,
uh-huh.
and you try to build a little beautiful Lantern Festival with fireworks and stuff.
Hmm.
It was a lot of fun, and
you know,
pretty easy learning curve.
The Settlers of Catan dice game uses a similar sort of vibe where you roll dice and stuff, but everybody has their own individual sheet where they're tracking things,
right.
and they're, like,
yeah.
disposable,
yeah.
But you only ever need the one sheet, and it's really very simple, like, it's not like it's complicated in any way.
The interesting mechanic is the player who just rolled the dice chooses, there's like a little thing, there's four dice in there, and you choose which one to point to you because you get to use that on your board,
uh-huh.
and everybody else gets to use the one you point at them.
Oh,
so you're kind of like you have a little bit, and then you have little luck tokens you can use to do extra things. It was a lot of fun.
Sounds like it cast you in the role of a deadly puppet master.
Yes. and then
the fierce gambit of lanterns.
And then I played a game called Babbage and Lovelace,
yep.
which is about the original users of the computer.
Yeah.
It's 2 to 4 players, and it is a math game. It is one of those games where you're gonna be like, ooh, or oh, fuck that. I enjoyed it. It is basically you have these little rows of operations. There's A 1 through 4, B 1 through 4, and each one of those has a corresponding thing. It's like plus 1, plus or minus 1, or plus or minus 5, or switch the digits of your number. And everybody starts at 55, and then you go through a series of operations as fast as you can to try and hit these numbers to gain these cards that give you points.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person who's done with their operations grabs this timer, flips it over, and then everybody else has 1 minute to finish. And they grab their player tokens to see who goes next. So it's a
math game and scary timing.
It's a real-time math game, David. It's your basic nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually like to see it. It doesn't sound uninteresting. It sounds kind of cool. But I think actually the math thing sounds potentially interesting. The timer thing sounds nerve-shattering
yeah.
to me.
If you're someone who likes real-time games, especially if you've got kids or teens who are struggling with math.
Yeah.
But struggling in a way where they like where it's fun. Not
right.
in a this is hard and I hate it,
right.
But someone if kids who like math and need practice, this would be a great game for that. It's also just it was really fun. I played with all adults,
yep,
and we all were not great at math, and we had a lot of fun.
Nice, yeah. It strikes me as the kind of thing that actually could be kind of good for people who are not into math, in the sense of it takes it and it you're there for the fun. You're not there necessarily to learn. You
right.
will inadvertently be,
yes.
you know, learning or sharpening up some basic skills.
And both of these are in our game library if you want to come take a look at them and try them out. That
oh,
kind of
nice.
Thing. All right. We're going to do a spoiler warning. We're going to talk about Mandalorian season one, or episodes 1 and 2. So if you haven't watched it yet, that'll be the end of the podcast for you. Yo, Joe, thanks a lot. And otherwise, let's talk about Mandalorian.
Now, a quick question. Did we, in fact, talk about Mandalorian?
We did. Nick and I had seen the first episode because we were both up late.
Right, and I had watched half an hour, and I was like, it's okay, it's not for me.
And then you watched the second half, which is considerably better than the first half.
Right, second half of it, and...
Well, it's the big action scene.
The big action scene with
right.
IG-11, played by Taika Waititi.
Right, which I didn't know while watching it.
Yeah.
He had an electronically distorted voice.
Yeah.
But it had, like, the droid was written with some of his trademark wit,
yeah.
and was a droid who was, at any time he seemed to be up against a threat that was a little bit beyond him, he started to set a timer to self-destruct.
Yep.
I will initiate self-destruct sequence.
This is great. What I liked was seeing the Mandalorian, who was kind of this cold-hearted badass throughout most of the first half of the episode. I liked seeing him suddenly in the second half, he ran up against stuff he wasn't quite ready for.
Yeah.
He basically had to try to learn to ride a horse, which was a big angry lizard horse.
Yeah, big angry lizard face horse.
And kind of helping him out was curmudgeonly, but kind of fun realist. He was an Ugnaught,
yep.
but voiced by Nick Nolte.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
And he had a great catchphrase, which is,
I have spoken. Yes.
I imagine it was Nick Nolte. In the Ugnaught suit, right?
I like to think that was Nick Nolte in the Ugnaught suit, yes.
I hope so, but I don't think so.
No,
what if that's
so.
What he actually looks like now?
I mean, that wouldn't shock me, actually.
Nick, what I wanted, I was telling Randy, I wanted him to recreate his infamous mugshot photo as the Ugnaught. but then, and so there was humor there, humor learning to ride the lizard thing, and then humor with the team up with IG-88 or IG-11. IG-11. And then there is a fun ending, and I had had the ending spoiled for me, but it it didn't particularly matter.
By the way, that shootout with IG-11 and Mandalorian against like the town full of whatever were was great.
It was. It was. You know, that's what actually made me go to watch it was because I heard y'all talking about it and saying that it was like the shootout in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where Clint Eastwood and Eli Wallach go through a town, reluctant allies in it, and like guys are popping out of every window and like up on top of every building, and they take out like 20 guys. It's one of the coolest scenes in The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and I was like, okay, there's an homage to it. Let's watch it.
Now, before we get to episode two.
Yep. Oh, by the way, he grabs a big laser turret gun there, which would be the equivalent of a Gatling gun in, like, what, is it the Outlaw Josie Wales that had the Gatling gun thing? A little bit like that, where he carves him up with it.
He used his little hook, the front end, that fired from
his grapple.
They're Mandalorian armor. He's got the flamethrower and the grapple, and there's some cool stuff with it. Before we get into talking about episode two, one of the things that's interesting is that this isn't Watchmen. Like, we don't have a lot of speculation about what's going on, but there's a little bit of, like, well, what's the baby about? And who was he? Who sent him?
Right. We are speaking of Yoda baby.
And someone else sent IG-11 and sent him to kill the baby.
Yes.
Whereas he was sent to bring it in alive.
Werner Herzog did say, I understand that, you know, sometimes you
have to kill things. He was like, he'll pay for him dead, And the scientist was like, no. Which leads me to believe that maybe he's engineered or something. There's a scientist looking for him.
Yes. Or it could be that race of you don't see that race very often.
Like, we don't know if Werner Herzog's character is an Imperial or not. Like, he has Imperial currency, he's got stormtroopers, but they're like beat up stormtroopers, and he could be just a crime lord.
Right. He's certainly a fun he's a fun, charismatic character.
Yeah.
Anybody who has not should read his thoughts about
Baby Yoda on the set.
About Baby Yoda on the set. It's actually kind of a charming story of a guy who's an art house director saying some kind of fun and not art housey things. He doesn't seem like he's being...
I missed this.
I'll point it to you after the recording.
And the other thing I'll say is that there's a sort of a mystery about who were these guys. Were they... I mean, was the Mandalorian in the wrong here? Were they the guys protecting this Baby Yoda?
Yeah, it could have been a horrific slaughter.
Yeah.
But they seemed kind of like they might have been bad dudes.
Yeah.
So cut to episode two, and what I liked about episode two was that it kind of showed that although this guy was definitely shown to be a badass, he is not by any means like a in charge of every situation.
Nope.
And in fact, this is the episode where he gets beat up like a noir detective.
Yes.
He gets his ass beaten by Jawas.
Yeah, man, when he shows back up and the Jawas are taking his ship apart, and he's just like, it's such a put-upon thing. He's like, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah. I kind of like, he keeps using the scope of his rifle, which I think is like out of some Western or another.
Yeah.
But when he gets down there, they've escaped in their sand crawler. And finally, we get to see the sand crawler, which is one of the most iconic, cool, giant things in all of Star Wars history, but was really just a background item. We finally get to see it sort of in action.
Yeah, rolling through the desert like a fortress.
Right, and he does not have a Boba Fett jetpack, so he's got to try and like scale this thing like a moving tower. And it's both funny and kind of cool. Like, I was happy to see the Jawas were not played. Yes, they're played comedically, but they weren't played as nothing.
They were threat when he climbs up on top and he pulls the gun on them and they all just blast him off.
Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah, they tagged him with, I believe, the little ion guns that they got R2 with back in A New Hope.
Yep.
And they just nuke him.
I will say, Mandalorian does, like, instantly disintegrate several of them.
Oh, yeah, he just disintegrates the Jawas with his weapon.
That was something else. It was a minor thing, but in addition to being darkly comedic, I was saying that, you know, in Empire Strikes Back, when they're telling Boba Fett that they want, like, Solo alive, they say no disintegrations.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, you know, I've always thought, we don't really see much in the way of disintegrations in Star Wars.
I guess Mandalorians like to disintegrate.
We did in this one.
Yeah.
He disintegrated them.
Yep, he definitely did.
They blew up, like, the people in the War of the Worlds movie when the alien beam hit them.
Yep.
Even the clothes fluttering down.
Yep.
And then he has to go steal an egg from a big beastie.
Right, because the deal is, like, Ugnaught Nolte.
Yeah.
whose name I don't remember as his character's name.
But that's his name now forever.
Ugnaught Nolte says, look, if you cannot, you can't beat them, so maybe you can trade with them. And what he doesn't have anything that they want, but he can trade his services as a badass.
Yeah.
Well, they want a couple of things, but he's not going to trade them.
Yeah, he won't trade him his armor.
He won't trade his armor, and he won't trade the baby.
Right. Oh, there was a neat... Wait, was it in the first one where they made the armor, the pauldron?
Yeah, that was the first one.
That wasn't the first one. Okay. And there are some little fun bits in there filling out the backstory of, like, say, how bounty hunters work, what's important to Mandalorians, and all that stuff. So it's this is not a deep movie, and they're a deep show. Like, in some ways, it's like an action show, kind of like how those almost the Gennady Tartakovsky ones were, but like with somewhat more depth than that. Obviously, those were just shorts, but there is some Star Wars lore and being filled out in it. Anyway, but yes, he goes up against a monster in the second half
and gets
the crap kicked out of him.
Yeah,
yes, but it also leads to a very sweet scene, a kind of a fun scene as a. Baby Yoda, like, right when he's, like, being charged down by the monster and, like, it looks like this is it, he grabs him telekinetically with force powers and, like, holds him.
Do we think this is actually, like, a clone
of
Yoda?
Is it a clone of Yoda? Is it another one of his race? We don't know yet. We don't know what the deal is with him.
Right. In fact, when I was... I had to look this up just to be sure, but... because everybody was calling it Baby Yoda. And I know that most people weren't literally meaning that.
Right.
But I forgot, there is no race name for Yoda's people.
Nope. Right.
We saw another one of them on the Jedi Council in the prequels. But that was it, and they never said what race it was.
But they also said that the baby was 50 years old.
Yeah, they said some races age differently, and Yoda was 800 years old. This baby is 50.
Right.
That's plenty of time to learn the Force.
Yeah, that's true.
But the baby, like, used giant force power.
And then he had to take a nap. He was so sleepy from it.
Look, the Force is tiring for babies.
So it's kind of cool seeing the Mandalorian, whose name has not been revealed. Do we think they're gonna?
He's the Mandalorian with no name.
But do we think they're gonna reveal it?
I think?
I kind of think that they might at some point. I think it's gonna be hard. Like, right now they're doing a very good job of keeping him enigmatic.
But
I feel like after 10 episodes or something like that, it's gonna be a little bit tougher.
What if he takes the helmet off and he's sized noodles?
Those people who think he's Boba Fett in disguise, I think they're going to be disappointed.
I don't think he's Boba Fett.
I don't think so either, because honestly, he doesn't seem as accomplished as Boba Fett. Unless he,
Boba Fett doesn't seem as accomplished as Boba Fett.
Maybe so. Into a Sarlacc.
All right. But there has been enough, like, clearly, I think the filmmakers have wanted, or at least the Expanded Universe canon has always wanted to make Boba Fett tougher.
Yes.
I don't think they would have him quite as newbie-ish as the Mandalorian's been portrayed. And I say that, like, he's still a badass, but you do realize he's got definite limitations in this.
Just cut a guy in half in the first minute of the show.
Sure. No, he's a badass. But I bet that they'll get around to revealing some things. I suspect that they will use the show as an opportunity to maybe reveal or to introduce Boba Fett at some point as a rival. And then that will allow them to then expand on how he got out of the Sarlacc pit, and if they want to, I posted about this on Facebook this weekend and like started a bit of a tiff amongst my friends by asking, is Jango Fett and Boba Fett, are they Mandalorians or not? And I got such a wide variety of answers, many of which dealt with like canon that's no longer in effect.
Yeah. Right.
But the fact that it's no longer in effect means that it could be true, but we don't. But like nothing's been set, or not too much has been set. I guess the Clone Wars cartoon did establish some stuff.
Yeah.
But I think whatever they want to solidify as canon, they could do if they have Boba Fett brought back as a rival or something, and then they could use that to establish whatever they want.
Oh, in the second episode, doesn't the Mandalorian go up against a couple of Trandoshans?
Yeah, there's that opening where the Trandoshan bounty hunters show up, and
which I thought was kind of badass too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Just because I like seeing Bosks, or that race of
multi-Bosks.
Yep.
Multi-Bosks.
Yep. Usually think of those mainly as a race that enslaves Wookiees.
Yep. I was going to say they're mean.
They're bad, bad people.
Yeah, they were used very well in the Rebels cartoon.
Oh,
or the Clone Wars cartoon. It's one of the two.
I think it was Rebels.
I think it was Rebels.
Anyway.
All I want to know is when are we going to see Forlom? Did we see Forlom or Dengar?
Yeah, Dengar, GTFO.
Let's see. Do we know how far past Return of the Jedi this is set?
5 years.
5 years is what I've heard, too, yeah.
Okay, those guys could absolutely still be around then.
Yeah.
Any major criticisms about the show?
It's lighter than I would expect it to be.
Yeah.
Like, for all that it is definitely aiming to be sort of Man with No Name in Star Wars, it's definitely more Star Wars than Man with No Name.
Like, right.
It does not have a lot of depth to it.
I was going
to
say, it's kind of fluffier.
Yeah, well, I'll say this. Man with No Name... tends to sometimes have a labyrinthine plot, but there's not a lot of depth to them. The most depth there was in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was about Tuco and his brother and their sort of parting of ways stuff.
Honestly, the Man with No Name really was kind of just there.
He's a bit of a cipher.
Yeah.
But he was kind of like a morally compromised guy with a code of honor and all of that stuff.
I think we're going to get the back history of who the Man with No Name is.
Oh, I'm sure we will, yeah. I don't have any major complaints.
What if his name is Sam DeLorean?
Part man, part DeLorean.
Yes.
No, I don't have just any complaints either.
Yeah. I don't particularly either. Like, it's been fun. I did see somebody say on my Facebook page, a friend say that he was kind of doing the, I think y'all are all a little bit pushovers if you think that this is as good as it is. I think you just want more Star Wars stuff. And I'm like, I think that he may be overestimating how good Star Wars has always been.
Yes.
Which is to say, I think the original trilogy is pretty brilliant kind of sci-fi myth-making. That you kind of, they've never been able to duplicate it fully.
No.
And everything else has been kind of a fun jaunts in that world to varying degrees. We can agree and disagree about, you know, the success of them.
Yeah, try posting about that Rogue One isn't as good as Solo and see what happens on your Facebook page.
I'm enjoying the fact that we're getting a Star Wars that is divergent of the Skywalker story.
Yeah,
I like that too.
We don't need anything more with Leia, Luke...
fairly minimal Jedi references, unless yeah,
except for Baby Yoda.
But I like delving into the rebels and or the bounty hunter world.
Yeah. You are sort of learning things about how they take contracts. There's fun stuff like the equivalent of like what would have been Confederate money, mm-hmm. Post Civil War, because he doesn't want to take Imperial credits or whatever because he's like these things are worthless now.
I like seeing the world in sort of a bit of a shambles as opposed to, or maybe like the Republic finding its footing, the Imperials are less than, because in all the movies
it's their Reconstruction era, right?
That's what
it would be.
Yeah it's like Which the Imperials fits. we have Death Stars and we have all this and we're going to kill everyone, and it's just like this one feels like they're kind of in their place. They're like pushed down.
Yeah, Dave, I think broke ass Imperials.
I think exactly. Reconstruction is 100% accurate. That's kind of what's going on in Good and Bad the Ugly, right?
Good and Bad the Ugly is actually during the Civil War, because there's a big sequence set holding a bridge.
Oh, yeah.
So it is actually mid-Civil War.
Okay, all right.
Some of his, I'm sure some of Sergio Leone's other movies do have characters dealing with the fallout.
Yeah. Anyway, we all like it. We recommend it.
Yep.
Go steal yourself a Disney Plus login from somebody. Somebody you know's got one.
Yep. Check it out.
Until next time.
Yo Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.